break and there are some 38 U.S. patents in addition to the great host of foreign patents based on, of course. As far as that list goes, I can take that across the hall and have it duplicated.
All right, that would be fine. Yes.
Should I do it now?
Well, either way, if you want to do it now, I'll take a break and you can
sure.
Ask you, was that midway through your undergraduate career at Cornell, the Depression came?
The what?
The Depression, 1929.
What was the Depression years, of course.
And I wondered what effect that had on you as a halfway through your undergraduate career.
He influenced my life indelibly right up to this day. Nobody who has not lived through the Depression knows anything really what it was like, can't even imagine. Secondly, anyone who has been through the Depression bears its indelible stamp. My father had some stocks, utilities, conservative stocks. I lost everything in the crash. To this day, I don't own any stocks. I have absolutely no faith at all in stocks. Bonds, maybe, if they're backed by the U.S. government. But they succeed in making those worth less and less every year. Well, of course, I'm for a stable currency, but no one else gives a damn. When they not only devalued and devalued, but then debased the currency here so that the dollar is worth absolutely nothing but a piece of paper it's printed on, I thought this was a horrible event that couldn't understand why no one else was disturbed by it even. You look at the consequences.
Yes.
So, of course, I had to get a job. When I left graduate school, and no one else would do a thing like this, but here's the U.S. federal deficit. Part of 1950, add another piece of paper.
My goodness.
Up to 1990. Now add another piece of paper, and you're way up there. You see it's becoming well-nigh vertical. This sort of thing disturbs me greatly and doesn't worry a single other person here. This is financed by borrowing money, but no one here, no one in the Democratic Party thinks we have to change anything. We'll just keep on borrowing, that's all. We just do that. Now, of course, the interest amounts to, what, a quarter of the federal budget?
Mm-hmm.
That is not an entitlement. And this will go up and up and up. Finally, they will stop lending us money. The whole thing has got to crash someday. Yeah. Indelible impression. Sure, I've been very conservative in my own affairs and everything else. Yes?
Your brother had graduated essentially the time the Depression started. He was 2 years ahead of you.
He graduated
in 29?
In 1929,
mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he went to work and in the, not my father's plant, but a chemical company in Newark that made dyes and leather finishes and so on. He worked there for a year and he said, I'm not ready for this. The pay was poor and the hours were tremendous. He decided to go back to graduate school. So he was only 1 year ahead of me in graduate school. And then he left without completing his thesis, and terrible thing to do. So in the end, he got his doctorate after I did.
Where did he spend his career after Cornell?
American Cyanamid Company in Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, yes, yes.
They brought him in as a microscopist, because at that time they probably still make ore separation chemicals, flotation chemicals, mm-hmm. the powder, the piece of rock, identify the ores, profitable ores in it, estimate, well, determine by optical means the percentage and so on, and then study the wetting of these and so on. Well, he went on to become an expert in microscopy. He got his doctorate degree with Mason, who got his under Shamo at Cornell. Well, he went on to extend microscopy to the identification of non-mineral things, and principally polymers and plastics, amazing what he could do with optical characteristics, not only identify the composition of a plastic sample that you give him, but tell you who made it and approximately when. Other people say, well, what can you measure with polymer? You measure the index of refraction. And that's all. Well, Ted had proved that there are 7 reproducible identifying properties of plastics of any polymer. Well, when he retired from American Cyanamid, he thought, oh, it'd be nice to be a professor too, and he got a job at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. He's still there. Gave a course, and he found he had to educate biology students on the optics of the microscope first, and then how to use it, because they didn't know how to use didn't know how to make the most of the actually high-priced, high-powered microscopes that they had. Well, from there to metallurgy and all of that. So out of his courses of instruction at North Carolina State, he wrote a book. And like his thesis, it remained unfinished. Year to year, year to year. And he's different. I'm stubborn and insist on finishing what I started. But Ted, his wife Betty, who was Helen's cousin and childhood playmate, said every morning he goes to that big desk and to continue writing the book. And what does he do? He goes back to the beginning of chapter 1. And so he begins to rewrite chapter 1 instead of going on with chapter 6, 7, 8. He had Betty type each version. This went on for 20 or 30 versions. And finally she said, no more of this. I just won't type until it's finished. Well, I have put the fire under Ted to publish his thesis, so he came to me and said, well, you help me to finish this book and get it out of here. I had already published a couple of books. I knew the mechanism and the timetable and so on, so I helped him and do it. And now he has revised it, and I refuse to go along and revise the whole thing and write the index and proofread it all again in my own interest. And he didn't like that one bit, but I got him to prevail on the young colleague there in Raleigh taught him not only microscopy, but how to teach microscopy. And so together they worked out a second edition, and that was a long time, a boring too, but it came out just 2 months ago.
Oh.
Even the publisher didn't like the fact it didn't have my name on it. She said, the editor-in-chief said, this is unheard of. You publish a second edition without your name on as well as your brother's. Well, then it turned out that she put my name on the first proof anyway. So I wrote her a letter. I said, this is none of my work. It's all done by my brother and by Tucker. If you put my name on the printed volume, I shall sue you for unauthorized use of my name for profit. Boy, that did it. Yeah. Yeah, so I never put together a proper list of publications and patents, because the sequence was never finished, and maybe someday.
I have a note here that says you work for something called the Halifax Corporation.
True, I don't know where you dug up all this, but...
And I was curious if that was while you were still doing graduate work at Cornell, or between undergraduate and graduate degrees?
While I was doing graduate work at Cornell. Summer job. Depression years, and depression continued on and on and on. And in order to get some money, I was lecture assistant and so on. I was just for the academic year, so during the summer I got a job first with the DuPont branch in Newark, New Jersey. They made pigments, zinc sulfide and lithopone. I learned all about making pigments, all I could learn there. And then, because I had experience in fluorine chemistry, I got a job with Halifax Corporation, and they made chlorinated naphthalenes as dielectrics for capacitors. All, no such thing as an electrolytic capacitor then. Capacitors made from paper and foil, all wound up, impregnated, dried out, a lengthy procedure, and impregnated with something. There's no point in just putting in paraffin when you can put in something with a dielectric constant two or three times as high. So the halogenated is used for that. What about Halifax? Well, that was absorbed by Union Carbide, and they stopped making Halifax because they saw some of the dangers of halogenated aromatic compounds, and especially the halogenated chlorinated polynuclear aromatic compounds. Mm-hmm. The fellows who worked with me in the lab the whole year, exposed to Halifax, developed tremendous boils, hinkies they called them, all over the necks, wherever the face, wherever it exposed to the vapor. And the Halifax people wanted me to work there after I got my degree. They didn't like it one bit when I didn't go there. But I didn't like the effects of Halifax. I thought this is a bad area to be in. The chlorinated biphenyls that Dow Chemical Company made were just as bad, causing trouble with skin, and that if taken internally even back then, and sure enough, later on, look at the trouble with the PCBs, mm-hmm. chlorinated biphenyls and transformers. Awful business. I think the whole chlorinated hydrocarbon business, including Freon's, is doomed, but there's still money in it. Did you notice yesterday? No, you wouldn't, no, you weren't here. At the airport here, a shipment came in and it was seized by federal authorities because it turned out to be a shipment of 100 or so tons of Freon 12 made abroad. See, contraband coming in. Yeah. So, all right, I was looking for a job after graduate school. And
had you thought about a teaching career as opposed to industrial career, or was it just because of the Depression you wanted to get a job?
Well, that is to laugh, because I had been lab assistant and lecture assistant at Cornell. I at least had that title on my record. And while I was working for Dennis there as a graduate student, the man who worked in the next laboratory bay there had a degree, PhD from Harvard. He was on a postdoctoral fellowship. He was separating or trying to separate the isotopes of boron by vacuum system distillation of the boron esters or boron alkyls, the project of Dennis. He thought the boiling points would surely differ in boron, and if you distill enough, you should be able to separate these things. It went on for 4 years. Well, that fellow had a wife and a child. He was looking for an academic job for 4 years. He had as credentials a degree from Harvard, postdoctoral fellowship at Cornell. He got a job selling easy washing machines on straight commission. During my last year there at Harvard, nobody came to interview with graduate students, none at all. There was one letter offering a teaching position, and that was for teaching high school chemistry at a city in Pennsylvania for a salary of $800 a year. And that was it. No other teaching jobs. So we speak about the Depression. These things made a searing impression on my mind, everybody who left there at that time. There were so many people wanting to stay in graduate school as competition for the graduate fellowships, and there the pay for those is reduced and reduced and got down to $600 a year for that, and the fellows had to pay for their board and room and clothes and transportation out of this. Many of them are just living on boiled potatoes. And get a room together, an apartment, five or six of them. And yes, those are bad years. So how in the world did I ever get a job at General Electric? You're going to ask that. Makes me wonder to this day. It's just that a man named Winton Ehring Patnode, who had graduated from Cornell some years back in the 20s, got a job at the GE Research Lab in Schenectady. And they Well, this wasn't the fluorine chemistry part, but Hot Point Company, a GE subsidiary, Cleveland, Chicago, I guess it was in Chicago, made electric ranges. A most astonishing use of an pure inorganic substance, almost pure. Fused magnesium oxide. Well, picture, you have a metal sheath, not so big around. Inside of it, more or less concentrically, there is a spiral of nichrome wire, the heating element. The sheath is grounded, said the housewife, who got a shock. The sheath, the helix, runs at 220 degrees. Now take that up to red heat, let's say 800, 900 degrees C. Here you have a space of 1 millimeter or less between the helix and the sheath, with a potential difference of 220 volts at 900 degrees. Tell me what you would use for an insulator. You ask most people about this and they say, well, I'd use quartz. And no, nor can you use corundum, aluminum oxide. That's, well, first place, if you know how these things are made by swaging, you know, machine shop procedure of swaging, you have a couple steel dies, whack, 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 as they go around and squeezes down the metallic sheath, compressing what's inside. You do this with quartz, it punctures right through the metal and comes out. And you do it with corundum, it's so hard it won't break up. But the answer is periclase, crystalline magnesium oxide, which has a sodium chloride structure, and with cubic cleavage, it will break up. And you put it in as a granular stuff, it will cleave and compact and squeeze out all the air and get down to something like flour in there and conduct heat like mad, and yet the electrical insulation is way up there. Now name me one other substance that has a very high heat conductivity and an extremely low electrical conductivity, and you'll be stumped there too. Yeah, periclase. So Hot Point Company was cut off from foreign supply of magnetite to make magnesium oxide to fuse, get their periclase. This was done in an arc furnace. They had to use domestic source because there's a fellow named Hitler who wanted all the resources controlled by Germany and all satellite countries that way. Didn't want to export any magnesite. Anyway, it was variable in composition. Hot Point Company said, we need an inorganic chemist, a clever inorganic chemist who can analyze these samples of magnesite as they come in and can tell us which ones make the best periclase, fused crystalline magnesium oxide. Well, the head of a chemistry, it wasn't a department, what do they call it, chemistry division of GE Research Lab in Schenectady, was a physical chemist who didn't know beans about inorganic chemistry. Know much about organic chemistry. He didn't know where to turn. Here they had Hot Point Company said, we'll support a research project over Louis Navius, who was a mineralogist and microscopist. We'll oversee this. We'll provide enough money so he can have an assistant and a livable salary. namely $300 a month for summer. You should get a student who will come there for the summer. Marshall didn't know what Coolidge director lab didn't know what, and so they turned to Pat Node, and he said, oh, I know just the one at Cornell, he's finishing up, and he could do this thing for you. So Pat Node wrote to me, and I thought, well, that's an interesting thing, but I don't know beans about Pericles. Operating an arc furnace, I never did that. Besides, I had a fellowship with Stock in Germany. And this was the Austausdienst fellowship, exchange fellowship. They took, say, I'm taking too long on this.
My point. No, I'm just checking the tape, that's all.
Yeah. Would you like to have a chair to sit in instead of that?
Oh, I'm fine.
Well, I. American recent graduates, American young men went to Germany, a certain number, four or five each year, and they sent corresponding number of German students over here as selected universities, and this was the exchange fellowship, which had gone on for some years. And Dennis said, you should apply for that. You don't have a job. That'd be good experience for you. Work a year or two in Germany. So I applied, since I had been Stock's assistant and had drawn the diagrams for that book of Stock's and Baker series. I wrote to him, and he said, well, I don't have anything, nothing possible here, but he put me in touch with Goldschmidt, geochemist, who was where? Berlin, Dahlem. Anyway, I applied, and boy, I was awarded this exchange fellowship, and I thought, wonderful, I can be in Germany for a year.